The master leapt and closed his hands around the doctor's throat. At first, the doctor was only aware of the choking weight of those hands clenched around his windpipe. As he struggled to break their grip, he noticed that the air was hot and full of smoke, that there was beaten earth beneath his feet. He was back on the planet. He was wrestling his enemy in the center of the valley, surrounded by spoil heaps of bones where the cheetah people fought their ritual battles. Part of his mind was aware of all this, and that they were in grave danger. Fissures were opening in the rocks. Lava was gushing down gullies. The planet was in its death throes. Most of his mind was consumed by a savage desire to fight, to kill. The power of the planet had never been so strong as it was now, when its very substance was breaking up into violence. The doctor wrestled his enemy with only one thought clearly in his head: to kill before he was killed. The master toppled the other Time Lord onto his back. He raised a huge bone, wielding it like a club, ready to bring it crashing down on the doctor's head. The doctor pushed him, sending him sprawling, and then pinned the master's struggling body to the earth. With his free hand, he raised the bone club in his turn. He looked into the master's eyes in the split second before he killed him. The doctor paused. He looked round. All the mountains were erupting into great explosions of flame. The air was full of cinders. It was too hot to breathe. The doctor felt his sanity returning. The planet was dying. All the wild things that could were escaping to new homes. So must they. He lowered his weapon, looking down at the master. "Time to go!" The master stared back up at him, his eyes still blazing with madness.
"Go where?" he snarled. "There is no escape except for the animals."
He bared his teeth.
"I do not choose to live as an animal."
His hands closed again with renewed fury on the doctor's throat. As the doctor fought back, he felt rage consume him.
"If we fight, we'll die,"
he howled, hardly understanding what he had said.
"If we fight, we'll die."
He saw the land around them dissolve into flame. With the last bit of himself that remained to him, he remembered that he too had somewhere to escape to. He leapt.
Welcome back to the Hamster Book Club. My name is Joe Ford, and I'm going one-on-one. Survival of the fittest today. And if we fight, David, we will destroy this podcast. We will destroy ourselves.
Oh, I think you're overdoing it a bit. I think you're making Sylvester McCoy look subtle.
If we fight like animals. No, okay, I'll stop. We are here to talk about Survival by Rona Munro, only my second foray into the classic Target novels. But I don't want to go there first. I want to throw an icebreaker question at you, because I never know what answers I'm going to get with these things. My question for you today is, which Doctor Who author do you think is undervalued or underrated or just not spoken about enough?
Do I give my joke answer or not? No, I'm not going to do that. When you asked this, I was like, I kept thinking of people going, you know, especially like the one-off writers going, but a lot of, in the TV and sometimes in the books, the one-off writers actually are sometimes quite lauded. And I kept going back to Rona Munro, and I think it's possibly because I've just read her book, and it's a great book. No spoilers. But in terms of the TV authors as well, you've got someone like Barbara Clegg, who wrote Enlightenment. You've got Rona Munro, who wrote this. And then bringing in the sort of wider, I was going to say Hooniverse, but you've also got someone like Jacqueline Rayner as well. Man. And I think, you know, writing things like novels like Earthworld, and particularly stuff like Marion Conspiracy and The Pirates, doing the kind of proper emotional, dramatic stories before the series came back and it became what everybody does now, and doing these brilliant things with character and also just evolving the Sixth Doctor as well. And you know, when people say about big Finnish authors and book authors saying they should write for the TV series, I don't think people mentioned Jacqueline Rayner enough. You know, it's always the sort of obvious candidates who are all good writers.
Always good. She's always good. She's often great, but she's never bad.
I don't think I've read or listened to anything that's been less than good.
I
And I
agree.
think, you know, and now there's an obvious connection between the writers that I picked, which is obviously that they're all women. And that's not me getting on my soapbox or anything, but Doctor Who writing is still very male dominated. And I think what was refreshing reading this book and looking at some of the other scripts that are written by women is that they bring something slightly different to the sort of tone of voice of what they write. I mean, you look at Barbara Clegg writing Enlightenment, look how she writes Tegan. You know,
Yeah.
Tegan's actually got a little, she's got a second dimension in Enlightenment.
Development. She gets character development in that
She get
story.
she actually compared to how she is in Terminus, where she's locked in a ventilation shaft on film for a week,
Do you remember the
and
line when she thinks he's dead and the fella goes to her, "You've lost the sparkle in your mind"? And that's, I think, maybe the one hint actually that she's got feelings for him.
yeah. And so they're just, and it's something we didn't see until certainly the Ace era of companions getting depth and actually getting some proper character development, which I feel culminates in the book that we're going to talk about. Because I think this is Ace's story. And I think Rona Munro writes it brilliantly. And I think better than the original version.
We'll definitely get to that. So, is Rhoda Munro your pick then?
I think it's somewhere between either Rona Munro or Jacqueline Rayner. I think now I'm going to pick Jacqueline Rayner because I think I would love to. I need to. There's certain some of the more recent stuff I haven't listened to, and I really need to because I've heard nothing but good things about them.
Yeah, Gwyn Dilemma and all that fantastic stuff. But I mean, look how long it took us to get a woman. It was set piece, wasn't it? Kate Ormond's first one. It was all men up until that point. And I think it was only Kate Ormond that was writing New Adventures that was a woman, right?
I think you're right.
I can't think of maybe I am wrong there. There's one other. And then you skip over to BBC and it's Kate Ormond, Jacqueline Rayner, and then Lloyd Rhodes jumped in as well, didn't she?
Yeah.
Spectacularly.
Did she do Camera Obscura? That
And
was
City of the Dead, yeah.
the Camera. I loved Camera Obscura. That's one of my favorites.
Gorgeous. Oh, wow. Coming to a book club near you. Camera Obscura featuring David Gillespie Pratt. Lovely.
There we go. Just throw that one out there.
And I'm trying to think of more women writing. I can't think of anyone else. They are sorely underrepresented, aren't they? But always, I think, always decent.
Yes.
There are a lot of bad Doctor Who books. I don't think there's any bad Doctor Who books written by women.
No doubt somebody in the comments will mention that one that we can't think of.
I'm gonna kick myself. I'll be listening back to this going, "Oh no, what about dot dot dot?" But never mind. Never mind. Well, look, then I am going to give a slightly controversial answer to the same question, which you mooted before we press play. And I said, if you don't, I will. And I don't want to talk about his politics because I think he's an appalling individual, but I do think he is a very good writer of Doctor Who books, and that is Gareth Roberts, who we can't talk about anymore. That's the problem. It's not that they're undervalued or underrepresented. We can't talk about him because he's so appalling. But back in the day, he was much celebrated author of those brilliant Fourth Doctor Missing Adventures, English Way of Death, what's the other ones?
English Way of Death, Romance of Crime, and Well Mannered War. Sort
Oh.
of the trilogy of Fourth Doctor Romana stories.
Fabulous. I mean, to mimic Douglas Adams takes some skill, and he does it well. But The Plotters as well, which is a very funny First Doctor book. I don't know if you remember. Have you read that one?
It's on the shelf. I never got around to reading
Oh
it.
man, that you gotta read it. There's a very funny scene where they're trying to get back to the TARDIS and they think they're witches. So they put all these sort of briars in front of the TARDIS and they're doing this ritual dance around it and setting it on fire just so they can jump in the door and get away. Very, very funny. Scenes of Vicky being mistaken for a boy and King John fancies her because he's gay. Actually, that does tie into Gareth Roberts' outside of Doctor Who. Let's not go there. But also Only Human, which is one of the best new series adventures, I think.
I didn't read it, but I remember when that came out, that got rave reviews. People absolutely loved that when it came out. But I think it's just one of those, you know, when people are like separating artist and art and everything like that. And, you know, I'm not one of those people who's like, I can't watch or listen to people who have different points of view to me, but there is a line that you have to draw at some point.
And I think it's a line that's personal to everybody.
Yes.
Because like I know some people that won't read H.P. Lovecraft and other people that absolutely revere his work whilst thinking he's a terrible man. I know some people that have difficulty watching William Hartnell because he's a famous racist, you know. And I feel like you sort of have to have a general overlook about these sort of things. You can't sort of pick and choose which offensive person that I said we wasn't going to go here, and here we are. Oh well. With Gareth Roberts, it is particularly annoying because he really has done some terrible things. And those books are really, really good. So one day I will get around to covering one of his very funny, very imaginative Doctor Who books. But not today.
Not today. No.
Well, look, let's push on from this and talk about what we are here to talk about, which is Survival by Rona Munro. And I've got a question for you to open out the conversation. Very simple question. Do you like this story? Now, I'm talking about the TV and the book here, which, you know, they've got the same story.
Short answer, yes. I think it's a good story. I think one of the strengths of it, and it's only kind of when you watch Survival and then kind of go straight into Rose, is that Survival's kind of a little bit of a prototype for some of the stuff that would come in the new series, in terms of more focus on the companion, the domestic setting, even like where it's set, in terms of, you know, you're going to tower blocks in London, you've got Ace's gang and friends. These are all things that are now quite staples of what Doctor Who is now. And Survival was kind of the first one to really do that. So it kind of ended at a point where the connections between Survival and Rose are actually, you know, production-wise, they're a million miles apart, but thematically there are connections. Mm-hmm. And I think actually, you know, you could take a storyline like Survival and you could possibly do a streamlined version of that now and still tell a very similar story.
I think you could do it with Rose.
Yeah, I think it would work with Rose. I think, and there's certain themes in the story, stronger in the novel than they are on TV, but they are in there in the TV version. And the themes of the characters and the motivations and everything, which are just really interesting. So I do think that it meant that, you know, the classic series ends strongly. There's certain things about the production of the TV version that the cat.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Sylvester McCoy's arse hanging out of that sofa in episode 3.
Yeah, I'm blanking that. I'm forgetting about that. But the cat. The one thing about reading this book is that you do not have to put up with the animatronic, manky looking, whatever the hell that is.
Did you notice how in the book, David, those Kitlings are in practically every scene, but they resisted doing that on the TV show because it looked so terrible?
Because they could, because everyone would laugh. But the Kitlings are ever present, and I think they are so much better done in the book. And actually, because it's prose, Rona Munro is able to actually explain better what they are and what they're doing.
Yeah, and the that relationship between them and the master
is
and
better,
them and the cheetah people, all of that.
It's all fleshed out so much better. And I think it's done in a way, I think when you look at, because, you know, this is one of the last Target books, and the adaptations, there's so many different ways that scripts are adapted. And you've got the ones like The Massacre and The Romans, and ones which are complete reimaginings of those scripts. And then things like, I always bang on about Time Flight, because Time Flight is probably one of the worst ones I've ever read, where it's basically just the script with some he said, she said added. It
And it's
is.
that script as well.
It's that script. If anything, if somebody said you could actually improve on this, you could actually make some of this work and make sense. It's like, no, it is so basic. And then you get ones like some of the early ones, some of the early Terence books, where they are really good retellings of those TV scripts, but there's just a little bit more
Through the
depth.
ruins of a city, stalk the ruins of a man.
And yeah, and they're a bit more lyrical, and they've got a bit more, a little bit more. And I'm also, because when I read Underworld, Time Flight, and Terror of the Autons on holiday last year, and I was always amazed, and I've probably said this before, that Luigi Rossini in Terror of the Autons gets more character description on the one book he's in, where he's a minor character, than they do covering Adric's death in Time Flight. You know, which is about half a page. And so there's kind of broadly this different, you know, different levels of adaptation. Survival's kind of in that early Target vein, in terms of it's a pretty, if not really faithful, apart from some stuff in the second half,
Yeah.
it's pretty faithful. I mean, it follows all the plot beats. It's almost following it scene by scene. You know, there's no deviations, there's no prologue or anything. It is a very straight telling and retelling, sorry, of the TV script.
I was talking to Cy Hart before this call, and he said he always found this novel disappointing because it isn't doing what all the other novels. I'm going to ask you a question about the other novels this season later. And I said, "Are you mad?" I said, "Because tonally, this is like way more brutal than the TV version, and like there's much more blood and violence, and like this really feels like Survival of the Fittest." Whereas the TV version, obviously, because it's going out at 7:30 opposite Coronation Street, they can't do all of
And you know, they can't do the cat, and the Cheetah people are the
that.
Cheetah people.
Puss in Boots.
Very cuddly.
They're very cuddly, yes.
And
Not too bad in close up, I don't think.
no, the close, certainly they put their money in Lisa Bowman's mask, because when you get the close-ups of that in later on in the story, it's like, I was watching it this morning, it's like, that's the close-ups hold up really well. It's just when you see them with their paws and their claws in
In the
longer shot.
long shots, you know, in the desert, yeah. I keep think I can hear, you know, Jellicle cats and Jellicle cats. You know, like they do look like they belong in a pantomime or something like that. It is very, very Puss in Boots.
But they get away. It's a good, I think I say, good, it's a good story, and I think it's Ace's story, and you know, it's leading with the companion, which is really good, and that's something that I think the McCoy era, particularly 25 and 26, get better at, is giving the companion not just lines, but actually giving them character development, giving them agency within a story. And I think this is one where Ace is actually driving the plot. And you know, in TV, so it's one of Sophie Aldred's best performances, but
Yes.
the way Ace is written in the book, the Runner Monroe adds just more and makes that character a bit deeper.
Right, well, let's start there then. Although I just want to very quickly say, and it's not really a spoiler because it's coming out on Sunday, but I have real issues with Sophie Aldred's performances across season 26. I think in Battlefield, she comes across as a little kid. And in Ghostlight, it's a very mature performance. Then in Curse of Fenric, unfortunately, this sort of angsty material is a bit beyond her and it's a bit embarrassing. And then in Survival, they're actually deliberately taking a younger character and maturing her. And that suits Sophie Aldred brilliantly because she is an older actress. She's something like 26 or something like that. And she's playing supposedly a 17-year-old. There's a line in this book, "Oh yeah, we're almost of age to buy alcohol." So I'm like, "Oh shit, she's supposed to be 17." Sophie Aldred don't in no in any way look 17 years old. And I think from what's on the page in Survival, that depiction of Ace, it's not what Sophie Aldred's doing for most of her run. Because Sophie Aldred is an older actress, she is playing the role in quite a mannered and almost middle class. The way she talks is quite posh. But as written in this book, Ace is a young, edgy delinquent who comes from a very rough area and was involved in they talk about smashing people through windows in the youth club. And, Molotov cocktails and things like this.
I think they say in the TV version, we sometimes would do a bonfire, but it's much clearer in the book that it's like, they're just burning stuff because they can.
They're angry and violent and pissed off.
And so her conflict, because obviously there's a whole bit where she's talking about being in the youth club when she's growing up and Shreela's trying to do her hair, make her all a girly girl, and then she's getting into fights with Midge and having her head smashed through a window.
It's good stuff, isn't it? It's
and it's like what the hell, I've written it down as one of my themes. It's the theme of home and belonging. And that is goes right throughout in terms of Ace is looking to belong somewhere.
Yes.
And she thinks it's not in Perivale, it's with her gang that's gone. And I think then when she gets to the Cheetah Planet and she's being bewitched by it, that comes over so much more strongly that TV version, it's just, she's bewitched by it. But because it's the draw of belonging somewhere, and that's what the planet is kind of drawing her in with, that is just, that feels so much more logical. It feels like a proper theme woven throughout the story. And that's the advantage of doing something in a novel form. You can't really easily do that in 3 25-minute episodes where you've got to have a cliffhanger every third.
You're not explicitly hearing Ace's thoughts on the telly, whereas we are in the novel. And there's a proper through line in the book of her landing where she belonged, back in the day, but no longer belongs. And I love it because there's something a bit Rose about her in those early scenes where she's written as, I'm going to be really smug and I've been off on all these adventures and I'm going to show off a bit. There's a few passages where, and then when her mate, is holding the collection tin outside the shop.
Oh, yeah.
Tries to, because she doesn't know she's been off having an adventure, and she compares her to the fella who's gone off to Birmingham to be a window cleaner. And she's so angry, isn't she? She's like, how dare you compare this amazing lifestyle I've got with that? And she's a bit arrogant and a bit cocky.
She does that thing of, they're going to be so happy to see me. They're going to want to know everything that's going on. They're going to be like, it's all about you. And in fact, actually, they're gone. The one mate that she does encounter is, and she was just unimpressed, but I think she's unimpressed by everything. And the one other person who remembers is Patterson, who gives her a bollocking. And so the great unseen character of this era is Ace's mother.
Yes.
And I asked this question on Twitter the other day, and it's like, ignore the new adventures in the books. Do they ever actually say in the series, she hates her mother? That's evident, I think, pretty much from Dragonfire when she ain't got no mum and dad.
yeah.
But she hate, and like, but do they ever explain why?
Just that it's a fractious relationship. And I had that with my parents, so I can completely understand.
And was there any temptation, particularly in either the TV version or in the book, to have Ace's mother in it? And I actually think it's better to not have it.
No. Oh, my God. That's one of the best things they can ever do in television. It would be like showing Sheridan in Keeping Up Appearances.
Yeah.
All the jokes wouldn't land anymore because everyone's got an idea in their head of this terrible character. I think, and for me, Ace's mum actually would be quite mundane. Quite a boring, mundane woman who just didn't work out as a parent. Whereas somebody else, it would probably be this, horrendously sort of violent, horrible woman.
And I think you end up going into things that this story's not trying to tell. And if you have Ace's mum turn up and she's all kind of quite nice and everything, that just makes Ace look like a total cow.
Yeah.
And you don't want that. And then you don't necessarily, do you want her to be a victim? It's like, well, they don't really want to tell that story either. So it's just, we just don't talk about it.
There's a wonderful line that Rona Munro wrote. Ace wished she had never come back. She wished she could leave, but she couldn't think of anywhere to go. And that's somewhere in sort of like the first third of the book. And then you're right, she goes through the whole experience of being bewitched by the planet. And then wonderfully, the conclusion is the scene, which wasn't on the TV, but probably should have been, between her and Shreela, right at the end, where she goes, "Are you ever coming back again?" Ace thinks for a second and goes, "No, I don't think so." And then in the very last line is her home, back home to the TARDIS.
And I think that's the line we lose, because they put on the speech at the end of it. And that's the theme of it, that, you know, when she leaps back home, same with the Doctor as well, they leap to the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And that's where home is now. But that whole bit at the end where Ace sets up a funeral pyre for Kara is so much better than what the...
And she makes something of that ridiculous set piece with the motorbikes, because she uses the bikes, doesn't she, to set on fire.
She does. And when I first read it, I was like, oh, is that a pyre for Midge and Kara? It's like, it's not massively clear, because I think she says Midge's body's at her feet. But I think, no, she... her relationship with Midge is interesting, because that's really built upon. Because in the TV version, it's just they bicker and whatever, but he's one of the gang. In the novel, they hate each other. And he's the one who smashes her head through a glass window.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, they were not mates. They were maybe at the youth center, you know, together or whatever, but they weren't friends. And the antagonism, and that actually makes that relationship between the two of them much more interesting. So it's not just, oh, he's a bit of a hothead. It's like, they genuinely despise each other.
I've got to say, freed from Sophie Aldred and Will Barton, those characters really come alive in the book. Ace as a genuine sort of delinquent, slightly reformed by the Doctor, but with loads of issues still to resolve. But Midge's character was a revelation in the book. And, you know, I don't want to throw too much shade on Will Barton, who's doing what the script says. But that's one of my big stickling points with Survival on TV, is his performance and, you know, all of that. Why do they eat us all up without ketchup and all that stuff? Whereas in that book, man, he is a nasty piece of work.
And what's really interesting about the book, I mean, this is... I was trying to decide, is it a feminist piece? And I think the way that the men are treated and the way the women are treated is that generally the men are quite weak. They're easily corrupted, and there is a bit... I'm going to see if I can find it, because it caught my eye, and I was like... It is when Ace and Shreela have kind of... They're in the sort of gathering where they're hiding from the cheetah people, and Ace and Shreela try to come up with a plan to go and do something about it. And there was just the way it was written. And there we go. It's on page 50. And it's, Ace and Shreela began to walk determinedly up the gully. Ace looked back over her shoulder at Midge and Derek. Come on, make yourself useful, can't you? The young men looked at each other and reluctantly trailed after the women. And I just, when I read that, and I was like, that is just pretty much setting out a store. One of the themes of this book is that who's got the agency? It's not just Ace, because Shreela's also got some agency as well. She's the one who wants to do something, but she hasn't quite got the background that Ace has got. And it's these characters who are driving things.
You've got a man who is bewitched by a man in this, and that's Midge by the Master, but he's bewitched to do terrible things, very masculine things, destroy, to kill people and all this. And then you've got a woman, Ace, who's bewitched by a woman, Kara, and that's far more just liberating her. And, you know, all those passages, there's a wonderful passage about Ace just running and the pleasure of running and sort of being connected and all of this. I think there is a feminist reading in this.
There is. And I think there's throughout, I think it's chapter 5, because when I was reading it, I was like, that making notes going, chapter 5 is just, which is about the second half of the TV episode for a bit of context. And I thought that's the best chapter of the book, because it's got Midge kind of being... I'm going to keep saying Bewitched, but it's where Mitch starts to transform, Ace starts to transform, and they're almost in parallel, because you've got his act of violence against the downed cheetah person, and then you've got her compassion with Kara, and they're kind of going back and forth between these two storylines, and it's like he's kind of giving in to the savagery, and she's not letting, she's keeping hold of her compassion. And I think the scenes are in the TV version, the scenes are sort of parallel, but the kind of the way it's written, the way that's all drawn out. And then occasionally you'll go back to Patterson, Schreuler and Derek and you go, yeah, they're just cat food.
I mean, I don't want to shit all over the TV version. Like, this, like Ronan Monroe wrote this script. All the ideas in this book are in the TV version. They just made a sanitized version that could go out at 7:30, you know, and it's still quite edgy and is pushing what it can do. I just like the fact that this is the Unshackled, that you said that the scene with Midge where he kills, is he's described as killing that cheetah person and feeling invincible. And then in the next scene, when he comes up to all of them, you know, and says, and he, you know, he's got the tooth in his hand, his arms are covered in blood from his kill. The book just makes him really scary. It is definitely like kill or be killed, you know?
It's a dangerous character. And then where they then take that in the final chapter, is it the final chapter, second to last chapter? Because obviously they all get home and TV version, Derek runs off and like, hooray, he's so happy. And in fact, actually the beginning of when he comes back, he's happy because they, you know, run him around because he says, oh, he's happy. I think he's playing football by himself or something. And he's in a good mood. And then Midge and the hoodlums turn up and they've specifically say they've changed out of their gym shoes, they're wearing boots, and they then proceed to kick Derek to death.
Oh, it's horrible.
It is
Patterson's death as well. He's described as being sprawled in the center of the gym, staring sightlessly at the ceiling, and they literally, the line says, he appeared to have been battered to death. And I remember reading that on the train going, oh, like, because I didn't get that from the TV version.
No, the slightly Amdram gym group sort of look at him menacingly, and then he's on the ground. But the Patterson's death, then Derek's, and then in the TV version, Midge sort of kills himself or does something. It's not in the book. And again, this is actually something. So in the TV version, what it's not clear the control or how Midge and the Master have over that gym group. It is so much explicit that they are mesmerized. They are basically, the Master's hypnotized them, either through his own hypnosis or through the cheetah people. It's not still not entirely clear, but basically he's got control of them and he uses them like a gang. And he basically turns them on Midge, and suffering a similar fate to Derek and Patterson, he is then kicked to death.
Yeah, oh, it's horrible.
You know, it's a brutal ending.
It's described as his charred, crippled body hit to death by the defense group. And I went, oh God, what's going on? Like, I mean, it's so horrific. And obviously they could never show any of this. But I think it really, in terms of the themes of the book, of it absolutely turning you into an animal, it's so explicit, it leans into the themes so much more potently.
And and other themes, you've kind of got that the feminist theme, you've got the theme of home, you've also got the anti-hunting vibe as well, which is coming with, especially with the stuff with Ange early on. But there's a whole thing, I think the Doctor comments on hunting at some point, you know, all that noise to chase one small creature. And again, this is if this was done now, if this was a new novelization, it would be woke. It would be, you know, probably. This is such a, I hate the term, but this is a woke book. And in everything about it, it's got something to say. And all the stuff about animals and animal rights and stuff with Ange and stuff. I did kind of wonder, like, what, of all the people got kidnapped by the cheetah people, they left Ange alone. They took everybody else's in Ace's gang, but they left her alone. And I was like, probably because she'd been totally unimpressed.
As a side note, on the TV, I love that character.
I think she's great. I think she would have just been sarcastic at them, or she would have sneezed on them with a hay fever. You know,
I thought you was dead. Either that or you'd gone to Birmingham.
To Birmingham.
Although, did you see the line she got? talk about things they didn't put on the TV, where she goes, I can't, hay fever. And then in the book she goes, it's most likely glue, though. She's a glue sniffer. JNT's there with a pen going, take that out. You could get that out for a start.
And no pun intended, the survival rate in the book is worse because the other characters that they bring back are Harvey and Len. We go back into the shop.
Well, it explains why Mitch is wearing those leathers and then suddenly he's in that dreadful like business suit. It looks awful.
Where did he get the money from? Well, he took it from the shop. Yeah. And Harvey and Len, well, we assume they're dead. They get taken away to the planet of the Chitter people.
And I think that bookends from episode one really well, to have them come back and then have a purpose. Because in episode one, you're like, well, okay, it's just a chance to have Hale and Pace in this. But in the book, it does make sense that we go back there. That's why we went to the shop at the beginning, to establish those characters so we could find that money. And actually, yeah, they get a cruel fate like everybody else, because that planet goes up at the end. So they're dead at the end of this book.
They're definitely dead. Or, you know, they transformed very, very quickly into cats. You know, there's a sequel. Maybe. There's a big finished box set waiting for you. But the other thing I really liked, going right back to the start, because we've got the shop and they talk about Sunday opening. And I think it's kind of there, but it's definitely the book, is that sense of Sunday. Yeah. Now, this is when you're kind of our generation, Sunday is
our generation. I beg your pardon. No, go on.
Grew up in the late 80s. Sundays could be fucking tedious.
The length of a Bible, I'll tell you. Sundays felt like they went on forever.
And, you know, if people think Sundays can be a bit dull now, it's like there was a point when hardly anything was open and there was a boredom to Sunday afternoons, yeah. Which I think the first chapter of this book captures really well, that sense of boredom.
And to be fair, I think the TV show does as well.
Yeah.
That's and what, in fact, she describes it as eerily empty streets like a ghost town.
And I also like how they capture suburbia in there, because it's all the neighbours are Mr. This and Mrs. That and everything, and it's got that dull suburban Sunday afternoon vibe.
Richard, get out of my garden. Go on, shoo.
Another performance we're saved from.
Yeah, Jesus. Flipping cats. Jackie Tyler making her first appearance in Doctor Who.
But I love the atmosphere. I think that's the thing with what the book can do is set that scene a little bit better. The TV version seems a little bit wandering around. We're also saved from some really dodgy direction, which will be when Ace is chased through the playground, climbing over swings and slides, which just looks silly.
Yeah, it's a poor director. He's trying to work with what he's got, isn't he? But on that book, it feels like a chase to the death.
It's a proper chase to death. And then when she goes through the portal and she ends up, you know, the idea that she is still running, she, you know, she doesn't have to pause for special effects. She's just kept going. And I think that the stuff with the kittlings are ever present.
They're described as shadows at one point. Shadows going around the TARDIS. I thought, lovely image.
So many chapters or paragraphs end with, you know, the red eyes of a kittling staring. You know, they're always
their
there.
Muzzles, it says, dripping with blood.
Things that, again, you just couldn't do on telly. But the relationship between the kittlings and the master is great. The idea that they're telepathic, they're kind of literally clawing at the door of his mind, because even the doctor says he can feel them trying to get in and he won't let them in. And I was like, the book explains that dynamic between the kittlings, the cheetah people, and the planet so much better.
It says the kittlings, they could smell blood even across the vacuum of space. Wow, that's such a great line.
And I sometimes wonder whether or not part of this book is Rona Munro giving some of the story a second draft, another draft, because there are certain things that are explained better. So one, how does the master control the youth group? But also, I watched this for years going, bit of a coincidence that it just so happens to be they're in Perivale. It just so happens to be a coincidence that they're hunting Ace's mates. And there is a line.
Anyone would think this is a coming of age story for Ace, you know.
And I think there's one line in the TV version where the Master says to the Doctor something like, "That's why I brought you here." But of course, he's brought him with Patterson. But actually, the book, much more explicit, says bringing the cheetahs to Perivale at this time was part of he was trapped. He needs the Doctor.
Yeah,
I know how to get him here. And so the whole reason they're in Perivale hunting Ace's friends is because it's the Master setting a trap.
On the TV episode, there is the line, isn't it? He does say, "I need your help, Doctor." But it seems like, oh, it's a coincidence that the Doctor's landed on the planet. He's realised he's here. And, oh, great, you can help me get home now. You'll get me away from here. Whereas, yeah, it's all part of a big plan, isn't it?
He sorts him out. And I think, again, another reason why I like that chapter five is that they do a whole bit about the Doctor's relationship with the Master. And I think it so well explains that relationship.
Brilliant.
And the short version is that when they were at the academy or whatever, the Doctor was the one who always won the prizes, always came first, and he was getting these accolades that he didn't want, but the Master coveted them so much. And the more the Doctor didn't want them, the more frustrated the Master became. And that was the beginnings of their rivalry.
It's the best ever reading of the Doctor and the Master I've seen on TV or in prose, because it actually gives the Master a motivation that I can believe in beyond, you know, he's just Fruit Loop. And the absolute best part of that whole passage, and it's a big passage, isn't it, where it's talking about their relationship. Ronan Monroe goes, "The Master had spent hundreds of years plotting the Doctor's destruction, but there was no indication that when their paths cross, that the Doctor had even thought about him." Burn!
That is brutal. And the way that's written, it's one of the best readings of that relationship, because it feels really believable. And it does away with the whole, the Master is mad and stared into it, is that basically they were just...
He's jealous.
And that's why he wants the Doctor's attention. And he wants him to notice him.
You must have... I certainly have. For people I know, I've seen jealousy turn into anger, turn into hate.
And the weird thing that it reminded me of, because I was reading going, I know this story. This story sounds familiar. There's an episode of The New Avengers, which is basically that story.
Oh my god, what, when the fella's going after Steed, all the things he loves?
Yeah, and it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Dead Men Are Dangerous. It's the same, it's basically the same story. It's basically a childhood rival who could never best the main character, and the only time he did was by cheating. And the end of the sentence,
wouldn't you? You'd think reducing them to that would actually belittle the characters, but it just makes perfect sense.
I think sometimes doing things a bit more down to earth for these larger than life characters, simpler, it works so much better because it's a bit more relatable. And I do prefer that kind of reading of it than, you know, is it? And there are some great stories. I think Master on Audio, Big Finish's Audio, is one of the best. But that is so melodramatic as well.
It's Timeless Children. I do love the fact that he's so angry about the fact that, you know, he's got the Doctor's DNA mixed in with him, and the Doctor's that important. But that could tie into this again.
That does
it?
Kind of tie into this. It kind of continues.
Not only did he win every fucking trophy, now you're telling me he is the basis of Time Lord society. I'm gonna kill him.
And I think the Master in this story is properly scary again. I think, and again, this is Anthony Ames' best performance on TV, and I don't want to take away from that, because I think. He's finally given the chance to underplay it and be quite softly spoken. I don't think he shouts all that much in it, apart from towards the end when they're having that fight at the end. But the desperation that he has, the fact that he's being worn down, that the whole thing with, it's much clearer in the book. I keep saying that, but it is his relationship with the Kitlings and the Cheetah people, is that the reason why he's helping them hunt is because it's distracting them from basically coming for him. He's doing anything to survive himself.
Yeah. Which makes sense of all those scenes where he's looking through their eyes and saying, yeah, hunt, take that one.
and that he's struggling to control them. Because again,
makes it so much more interesting, don't you think? That he's vulnerable.
He's very vulnerable in this, and there are times where he's trying to use the Kitlings to follow Ace and the Doctor, but they're more interested in. I think it's when they're looking at there's a group of kids at one point, and it's like no, and in TV version, it's just oh no, not them. But actually, in the book, the Kitlings are really quite scary. Because they would just go for anything if they could. But he's actually doing the right thing.
Smell blood across space. Oh, God.
And that relationship, when it's spelt out, and the fact that the Doctor can sense them as well.
What happens then is because you have all of that insight into the Doctor and Master relationship, it means the scene at the end where they fight as the planet is literally being torn apart around them, that genuinely feels like the sort of the Reichenbach Falls moment. Like, finally, it's all led to this, you know, and we're both savages and we're going to tear each other apart, you know, and the Doctor says, no, I'm not doing that, you know, we're not doing this, we're going home. And the Master's like, no, I'm just going to fucking kill you. I hate you. You know,
I finally got what I need. the rage of this planet is what I need to destroy you. And it's not enough.
What that means is that you have two parallel stories taking place, but it isn't really the Doctor and Ace. It's the Master and Ace. Ace's homecoming story and deciding that she belongs in the TARDIS, and the Master's story of, you know, his jealousy of the Doctor, and that sort of coming to a climax. Weird enough, I think both on TV and in the book, the Doctor's a little bit back from the action. You know, he's sort of having fun with the cats at the beginning, and he's offering advice in the middle sections. And then he's on the bike and all that at the end. So he's there, but the focus isn't really on the Doctor.
It's not his story. And, you know, they have that tiny little bit at the end where he's got the yellow contacts in. It's just it's starting to affect him. And it's like, because again, the TV version doesn't get the opportunity to go into that. But in the book, it's the fact that he's been fighting it off. It's much more explicit that he's been fighting it off. So the fact that in that moment of weakness where the Master attacks him. And I think there's another theme as well, because there's almost an anti-war theme, because basically they kind of say when the creatures of the planet fight, it causes the explosions that destroys the planet. And it's like, well, this is the late 1980s. It's kind of it's kind of now, you know, that fighting.
We're ready to tear the planet apart, aren't we?
If we fight amongst ourselves, we're going to destroy this planet.
It's all like, we do, David, except on this podcast.
Oh, this is we're the podcast that just stands still and doesn't move.
Don't move.
Or if you see the outtake, he says a lot more.
Fucking stay still, all right? Although you say anti-war, definitely, because then you've got Patterson in there spouting all of that militaristic garbage. And then actually, you know, this brute of a man on the SAS Survivor is a total fucking wimp when it comes to it. You know, when he's in a situation of extreme peril where he's got to use his instincts, he's a coward. He's terrified.
He can, even to the very end, he's still so sure of himself. And I think there's just that moment when he sees Midge in the community center. And there is that kind of, oh, fuck moment. He's kind of, he knows he's done. But
well, he tries to pass it off like it never happened, doesn't he, you know?
Yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, it didn't happen. He's imagined it or whatever. And call yourself a doctor. And, yeah, and it's a bit like what they did. I was just, you saying that just made me think, going, because Julian Holloway, who does a good performance. Brilliant.
Yeah, totally committed.
But in a way, if physically, should they have had somebody like with Pecs in Paradise Towers? Yeah, you know, should they have had somebody who was a bit bigger, a bit broader to kind of really sell that?
So it's quite a surprise when, you know, he's running away.
You know, that actually he is a total coward. And, well, I mean, not coward. I think he thinks he can handle. He's one of the people who thinks they can handle situations.
All bluster, that mask of like, I can take on anything, throw anything at me, you know, I can do it. And then he's in one situation that's out of his control, and he can't handle it.
And yet he's still there. And there's that bit. So I think it's during where Ace is having her moment with Kara, and Midge is transforming. And then every now and again, you go back to Patterson, Shreela, and Derek. And Shreela's just rolling her eyes at him constantly because he just keeps going on about, oh, yes, I eat the worm stew and stick with me and I know what I'm doing. And she's just like, whatever.
You're not.
She's totally unimpressed.
Whereas she's very competent, isn't she? And she's trying to think up ways to capture the cheaters and all sorts.
And she's taking charge. And it was good that they could have, because she just disappears from the story. They bring her back with a can of petrol to basically start a bonfire. You know,
that image, because like, do you watch Shameless? The show
I watched it for a while and then I got a bit bored of it. But I think
the title sequence opens with the bonfire and the council estate and all that. I really was getting that imagery when they were doing the bonfire at the end. I could see the two of them on a council estate, and I can see the sort of characters that Rona Monroe perceives them to be.
Because there's sometimes with Ace that you kind of think she's from Perryvale. She probably like acts like she comes from like, you know, the rough council estate, but she probably, because it's the rest of suburbia there was all very nice and middle class. I mean, she probably comes from a very nice, you know, very stable, very middle class upbringing, and she's just being a bit of a delinquent. So she makes out that she's rougher than she is. And that would have been quite a nice twist if it turned out that all the stupid insults and everything, that's just her trying to sound hard and just being really rubbish at it, because it does sound a bit rubbish. And but, and we are spared a lot of that in the book.
The script and the book makes it explicit that she is a rough sort of a council estate girl, you know, and she was part of a gang, and they were doing fires and Molotov cocktails and throwing each other through windows and stuff like this, you know. And that, I think, if had they hired a really edgy young actress, and there must have been some around, there must have been, if they'd cast the net wide, I think the Ace we would have got on TV maybe would have been less sympathetic, because I think her relationship with McCoy, Sophie Aldred, is so cute and watchable, but I think it would have been a bit more interesting and uncomfortable.
I always feel bad for criticizing people's performances, because, you know, I think their chemistry is fantastic. I think that's what carries you through these, what, 8 or 9 stories that they do, is that they clearly like each other. They clearly have a great dynamic together. It's just that they're neither of them are the greatest performers. And I think sometimes when
they're getting challenging material like Fenric and stuff like that, it's very frustrating, because I can see what they're going for. But for me, it doesn't work.
And I think that's why, one of the reasons why I think this book is stronger than the TV version, is that it's removed from, you know.
It hasn't got McCoy and Aldred in it. Yeah.
I mean, the best way to do it is, you've got a good example of McCoy's acting, is if you look at that line, if we fight like animals, we die like animals. He does it twice. The first time when they're on the cheetah planet, great. I think that's an iconic moment. You then cut, he does it again in the street. And I was looking at going, I'd have cut that.
Because it's sort of like, if we find like animals, we'll die like animals. Oh.
You know, and it's like, you could have just had like the last syllable of animals, and just that's, so it's like, he can do it, but he just couldn't at that particular scene.
I think it's for me, the whole Ace thing, it reminds me of the Kangs in Paradise Towers. They are supposed to be sort of dirty, rough, urban girls. And unfortunately, they've dragged in a load of, you know, drama students from Eton to play them. So it's, you know, middle-class people playing rough, dirty, urban girls. And, you know, I don't want to labour the point too much, but I do really think this book shows a window into what could have been.
And because this is number 150 of the Target books, and at the end, is it Peter Darvill Evans in his little postscript says, well, you know, we're nearly done, but we've got exciting plans for the future. And obviously we know where that goes.
And we're gonna be broader and deeper than you've ever been before, baby.
And I think some of the themes and the character choices from this book feed into what comes with how they take the character. I think there's always that thing about them, people say about some of the McCoy novels as their proto new adventures. I haven't read a huge number of this era, but I can kind of see where people are coming from.
And the trouble is they do try and rough up Ace like this and turn her into new Ace, but unfortunately they squeeze her into this PV suit and make her desperately unlikable when she's trying to hurt and torture Bernice, who we love at every turn. And it's like, no, go read Survival the book again. That's what you're aiming for, you know?
I was quite glad when they finally got around to writing her out.
So it was like by a woman as well, Kate Allman.
Yep.
One of the few women that actually could, writers that actually could make that character work. Well, look, I've got another question for you, sort of completely away from the characters. It's sort of three questions in one. So good luck. But how did you find the prose of this book? Like how it was written? Because the page count isn't high. So it isn't like Remembrance or Curse of Fenric, which run to nearly 200 pages. This is 100 and...
to 130.
Yeah, not many. But also, how do you think she, Rhona Munro, wrote sort of the wildness of the planet and, you know, the volcanoes and all of that? How was that? How well was that depicted? Because that's one of the things I would think works brilliantly on the TV story, especially with the score as well.
Oh, the score's fantastic. I think she writes it really, it's really pacey. I mean, it's 130 pages. It covers everything the TV story does with a few bits added. But it rattles through. The pace of it is great. And I think, I say, she captures, you know, the first couple of chapters where you've got that sort of Sunday afternoon lethargy, she captures that so well. I was reading that going, I remember those Sundays. I remember that kind of that boredom, that sense of there's no one around and everything like that. I think she gets that. Then when you get to the Cheetah Planet, again, it's not done in huge chunks of detail. Every bit that she uses to describe the planet of the Kitlings or the Karen, it's telling and driving the story. There's not a word wasted.
There's always a line in every scene that's reminding you that this planet is about to burn. I think when Ace first lands there, it just says the area was, the desert was ringed with volcanoes. You're just always aware of this sort of turbulent explosion that's due.
She's great at setting that scene and keeping you in that scene. And by doing that, constantly reminding you of the danger of this planet, you know that it's about to explode. I think it's a little bit there in the TV version because you've got the landscape, but it really kind of hammers home that this is a dying planet.
What's nice is in the book, she gets more of a chance to talk about the backstory of the planet as well. She says it had huge cities, fleets of ships, but they were all reduced to ashes, bone and blood, which I thought was great. You know, basically, it's all devolved into this savagery and wildness, this wonderful gleaming sort of science fiction cities.
It's again, even, you know, a Time Lord can be corrupted. These great cities can be corrupted. You know, this is the power of this planet is
it's
massive.
It's in you, isn't it? It's something that's inside you.
It's a primal force that's in all of us. And it's whether or not you give it. It's not so much if you give into it, because Ace kind of gives into it, but she gives into it in a different way. She gives into it, as I say, Midge gives into it due to his anger and his hatred and his terror. And Ace gives into it because of her compassion and longing, belonging for home. And so it affects them in different ways. And I think the planet feels properly dangerous. I think there's a, you know, it's, you get a sense of that in some of the direction and everything, but the book, it's kind of, this is a bad place to be.
There was one line, right, in the book. Once the power of the planet awoke in you, you would share its strength, its wildness, and its savagery. There, it's in one line, and it says everything.
The planet is a character.
Yeah, oh, and sure.
Very much, you know, it is one of the most interesting planets I think the classic series ever did.
Yeah.
And I think it's so well characterized, both on television and in the book. And I think the way she writes it, the descriptions, the sense of danger, it's some of the targets can be very functional. And this one, it's functional, but it's written so well. And it's just, it adds those extra layers to it as well. And layers to the characters as well. Like having Ange, who's basically just a two scene character and only, but she's given enough. Okay, she's off her face on glue. But,
yes.
You know, she invests that character with enough personality because she doesn't really do it. She doesn't drive the plot much apart from giving a bit of information or anything, but she makes her interesting. She's carrying some of the themes of the story. You know, that. It's,
I think everybody does. Every character does far more explicitly in the.
And I think, you know, there's not a word wasted in that 130 pages. Everything is
pages. You can't, can you? You know,
everything is driving the story, and it's, and what I sometimes find with some of the targets is when you look at how the you know, episodes and page counts split, I find quite a lot of them have a lot from the first episode, and then gradually they have less and less. This felt fairly even.
I mean, I thought the third episode was the one that in the book was what deviated the most, that last third.
And kind of doing the things that, well, you couldn't do on TV, but also just, I think this is what I think, sometimes I think whether or not this was just an opportunity maybe to fix some of the, you know, was she fixing some of the bits that she thought didn't quite work on television?
Oh, definitely. Did you watch the documentary on the series 26?
I probably did a very long time ago.
You've got Lisa Bowman on there going, oh, we got this script through, this amazing, lyrical, character-filled script about this planet that bewitches people and survival of the fittest and all of this. She goes, and then we saw what hit the screen, and she goes, and like Rona and I, we were, our hearts sunk because this could have been something so powerful. And unfortunately, we've got a Doctor Who budget, which isn't massive. And, you know, they did their best. And there's great things about it, like we've said, you know, the realization of the planet, the score, some of the performances, all of that. But yeah, I think ultimately a feeling of disappointment was there, that what hit the screen wasn't quite what was in Rona Munro's mind. And absolutely, she's taken the opportunity to rectify those.
And I think as well, because Lisa Bowman does the audiobook, and I think that's a fantastic reading. Mm. And highly recommended, because I think she does it so well. And again, I think it's only about three and a bit hours as well. So it's certainly one of the shorter of the McCoy audiobooks as well. And I think the best thing about that is the cover to the book, which I think is fabulous, and it is one of my favourites, is it looks so much better when they've got rid of that slightly, they don't quite know how to position that logo. Because
yes.
You're looking at, I was looking at it quite closely going, it's a bit too big. And it's like when on the CD version, it's got, I think it's got the McGann logo on that one. And it's just integrated so much better. And going,
those claw marks.
Claw marks. That's
such a creative way.
And it's very pink.
It's very pink. Oh, I quite like a bit of pink, though, you know.
There's something about this book and the last book are the garishly pink covers, because we did Mad Dogs last. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And we're due to do Quantum Archangel, which is not pink, but it's garish.
Very purple, though, isn't it? We're doing the gayest Doctor Who books.
We are definitely. So here's a question there, because there's a reading, certainly of the TV version, about the lesbian subtext between Ace and Kara. I don't think it's... I sometimes wonder whether or not people, certainly with the TV version, are people reading into something that may or may not be there? I'm not sure. It's one of those ones I'm on the fence with.
Well, Rona Munro says absolutely that it was there in the writing. Not obviously explicitly said, but it was more the awakening of something inside you and being afraid of it, rather than Ace fancies Kara and wants to have, you know, cheetah sex. Like, it was more about that, you know, that very powerful realization there's something different about you, and being afraid to explore it. And I think you can definitely give that reading, because that's sort of general. Whereas as an actual sort of reading on lesbianism and Ace being bisexual, no, I don't. I think maybe the moment where she's cupping Kara's face, like, you could maybe read something into how that's performed. But no, I don't really see it either.
And I think because that's when I got the book going, I wonder if it's going to be, because have you seen that reading and whether or not I've picked up on it or not, but is it going to be, is it in the book? Is that where maybe people are getting it from?
But did you not think in the book it was even less? I thought the relationship between Ace and Kara was far more in your face on TV than it was in the book. In the
That was my.
book, the focus was all on what's going on inside Ace and how, how she's changing.
Yeah, I was expecting there to be more of it in the book, and so I was a bit surprised when actually it was less. That Kara actually probably feels a bit less of a character in the
Yes,
book.
yeah, I
She's
agree.
probably the one that actually has less to, or feels less present compared to a lot of the other characters who get built up and get.
We said about Will Barton's McCoy and Aldrich sort of ruining things. This is the other way around. We haven't got the fabulous Lisa Bowman playing her in the book, so except on the audiobook,
And
obviously.
elevating what is probably a very, very small, probably they did a
Yeah.
thankless part behind all of that stuff. And you're watching that going, she is giving so
She
much into
embodies
that.
it there, doesn't she? Yeah, and then with that, just that one scene where she gets to play her as herself is great.
And it's one of the scenes, it's great on TV and it's great on the page, is Kara and the Master at the end. And it's, do you bleed?
Yeah.
I love that. I thought that was, that sense of scary thing get scared, which I think that's a Buffy line, but basically the master is briefly shaken by the fact that he can't control her.
Yeah.
And I love that bit because it's that's not in the performances at all, but in the book there's that moment where it's like he's genuinely scared of her.
He's really confident, isn't he, when he's saying, you could do nothing to me. And then that, just that one line of, do you bleed? And he
Except
sort of, he steps back in the book, doesn't he? Like,
he
oh,
does, he recoils, and it's like,
yeah.
I can do something to you if you bleed or something like that. And then he dashes for the knife as well, which is, again, it's the rage and the fury and everything, as opposed to, oh, it's because the master did stuff like that all the time. He casually killed people all the time. But the idea that this is him giving into his rage. And again, it's just that those little details. And I think it's one of the best Master stories because it gives him that character development.
Think it's worth pointing out as well in both versions of the story that Andrew Cartmell is pushing the TV show in so many fascinating directions that it's never touched on before. The exploration of the companion, the urban setting in this, wildly experimental ideas like the planet that bewitches you, all of this stuff, like Doctor Who just 5 years ago wouldn't have touched anything like this. It wouldn't have dared to be as sort of edgy and interesting as this.
It's a story that has something to say because if you fought the fires before this, you'd be season 2021. What's Ark of Infinity trying to tell us?
Ah, pulse loop, the very thing. Fetch it, Thalia.
I think Doctor Who's the most interesting when it has got something to say. I think that's why some of those early Target books, the Pertwee books, are so lauded because they're taking what was on TV where there was a message or there was a political slant or something, and building on it as well. And I think this is very much a book in spirit of some of those Malcolm Hulk books and stuff. It's got a message, it's got a voice. It's not just taking the script and adding some bits to it.
It's got an identity of its
Yes.
own. It's unique. And I think you can say that about a lot of these McCoy stories. They're not just hackneyed nostalgia trips like the mid-80s. They are trying to do fresh things. Well, look, I'm gonna sort of round off the survival thing by throwing a couple of questions at you. One, I want to know what you think, how this compares to the other McCoy novels of this season, because I think this is a bit of an outlier compared to the others. And two, just if there's anything we haven't covered in your notes or anything that you would like to add before we sort of move on to the recommends.
Oh yeah, so with me in Target books, I've probably listened to or read about half of them, and I tend to focus more on either the early Target books or the stuff from 60s and stuff because that's generally where I was gravitated towards in sort of classic series. And I'd never read this until you suggested it, because originally we would said we'd do commentary on it, and you said, should we do the book? It's like, okay, that thing people talk about, you know, the late McCoy books were kind of proto new adventures, and I love the new adventures. So I was like, fine, okay, I'm going to see how true that is. And there is some truth. And after I'd read this, I went and picked up Remembrance, because I think that's the one most people seem to talk about in terms of lauding. And
with good reason.
Very good reason. I think, again, it's a fairly straightforward retelling of that script, but just the layers.
POVs. That, I mean, the Dalek POV is incredible.
And all the stuff that's added to that, just building up that story. And I did listen to Ghostlight a while ago, and I remember really enjoying that as well.
It's
and that
Ian
was also
Hogg as well, isn't it?
A really reading. Good reading as well. And you know, they're taking the opportunity, because it's, if it's not by the same writers, I think they're written by other authors who were writing at the time. Because was it Mark Platt who did Battlefield?
And a sterling job of it as well. He actually takes what's a very frothy TV story and makes it kind of hard hitting in places.
So I am going to try and pick most of these up, because I'm kind of really quite intrigued. I think at the same time, because I had it on an Audible credit and somebody was bad-mouthing it, I picked up Eric Saywood's Revelation.
Oh, bless you.
and then I listened
again
to
with this. Good reason.
And then I listened to this, and it's like, even though that's a more modern adaptation, there's a good example of how not to do it.
Yeah.
And it, because that was poor. That was really poor. And that's a story for another day. But
maybe we should do that one day.
Oh, I think
a hate episode, you know.
I just want to know how many times Eric Saywood refers to him as the Time Lord, because he just seems that's keeps to, it's like, think of another description. And Davros turning his head 360 degrees, yeah, going, that's not quite what you think it means.
As anyway, he usually does. I think he just got, does he? Okay.
So I think, like I say, I've only reread kind of two or three books from this period. And it does, I suppose, in a way, it is a bit slighter.
Yeah.
You know, it's not adding the reams and reams. It's not adding the, as I said earlier on, it's not adding a prologue and an epilogue,
Fenric,
and all the stuff.
Adds reams of backstories for all of his characters.
This story doesn't need it.
No, that's the difference.
And I think the thing I noticed watching this and reading this is one of the problems of season 26 is, as great as it is, and I love 26, is that the stories are overwritten. That's why we've got extended versions of two of them. There's Ghostlight that probably would benefit from adding in quite a lot of the stuff they cut, but I know that's difficult. This is one where I think you don't get the sense they've had to cut huge chunks out of the TV version, which is then being rectified in the book. It's better structured story, so therefore it translates really well to a pacey 130 page novel. It doesn't need to add in all the stuff they cut from the TV version. It's added a few bits in that final third. It's built up and kind of made things a bit more dangerous, a bit more serious. But it doesn't need to go, oh, actually, you know, we dropped that plot from the book, and we dropped from the TV, so then we had to cut these bits out, and we can put them all back in, and oh, actually, we can make these things make more sense. Because one of the common complaints for Ghostlight and Curse of Fenric on TV is sometimes they don't make sense.
Yeah. But as well, like you said, it doesn't need it as well, because what's important about survival is what these characters are going through now, that transformation they're going through right now. We don't need oodles of backstory about Patterson in order for his input in this book to make more sense, you know?
It would be bloated if they start putting like entire, you know, chapters about Patterson's backstory. We get enough to tell us who that character is.
And yet she subtly makes this more mature, more adult, more violent, but not with like elongated descriptions of like the new adventures would go on to do, of torture scenes and things like this. It's just gentle descriptions of the savagery of what's going on.
And I think, like you say, Midge covered in blood, and stuff like that. You know, it doesn't need reams and reams of description or anything, just a couple of sentences.
You know, those people that she's killing off at the end, the fact that it's described as leaving a trail of bodies for the Doctor and Ace to then get to that hill where the motorbikes are. You know, just that, so simple. One line.
One line. And there was there's one, and I'm touched on. So Derek's fate is like a paragraph or two, and it's just Derek was playing happily outside his home. One sentence. You don't need anything more than that. It's basically she sets it up as he's back home, he's happy after everything that's happened to him. And therefore, you don't need more than that. So when gets kicked to death, it's horrible. But she does that in one line, establishing that character again.
I mean, going back to the original question, I do think there is a certain pretentiousness to some of these McCoy novels where they are trying to elevate these TV stories way above just being four-part bits of bumf for the kids to watch on the telly. And for the most part, it works really, really well. You know, Curse of Fenric is a great book. But, you know, it ain't a fucking Bible or anything. It's not a great work of literature. It's a potboiler at the end of the day about a load of vampires converging on one coastal town, you know, and a chess game playing. Like, that's what the story's about. But suggesting it's this huge, you know, treatise on religion and, you know, evil since the dawn of time and all of this, they can sort of get above themselves a little bit. And this doesn't do that. This just tells the story that was on TV really bloody well for a slightly more adult audience.
It does what it needs. It's a strong novelization. And it's not, in a way, it's not one that I see when people talk about, you know, the McCoys that became the New Adventures, it's Remembrance and Curse of Fenric and Ghostlight. This one doesn't really get mentioned. And it's like, that's not terribly fair. This shouldn't get overlooked. This is a really strong book, and I'm curious to look at some of those others now. I think, you know, when more Audible credit is in, I might get Curse of Fenric, because it's a story I enjoy on television, so I was like, I would like to see what the book's like. But
it'll be a lot longer than this audiobook, that's for sure.
I think it's about 6 hours.
Oh, bloody hell.
And there are times where I do go, that's a lot of time.
That's it's three runs, that is.
Sometimes it's down to who's reading it as well. I think if you've got a good reader, it's fine. If you've got one of the not so good ones, I'm like, I can't get on with it. I mean, I tried listening to The Power of the Dalek, the new Power of the Daleks that they brought out, and I just can't get on with Nick Prix's reading.
Fair enough. I empathise entirely. Well, look, any other points about this book? I've only got one other point I want to bring up, and it is another comparison to the TV episodes again. I want to reiterate, I think there's great stuff happening in the TV episodes, but this just sort of explains very vividly how stuff can so much easily be smoothed over in the books. So it's the bit where the milkman appears, where and in the book, you've got them sort of going through a sort of gully in this quarry, and the cheetah people would look like puss in boots are going around them, you know, and sort of clawing at the air. McCoy's going, don't move. And then, you know, they all get through and go, oh, thank God. And then the milkman appears and he's like, oh, and the music's like, and it's like comedy. And like, oh, what is going on? Like, in the book, it is absolutely, if they rouse these cheetah people that are just lazing about in the sun, they're going to die. And they are literally going to be torn. They're going to be eviscerated by these things. And it's a really tense sequence. And you get to the end and everyone's breathing a sigh of relief. And it literally, the line at the end is, and then the milkman appeared or something like that. And it just lands brilliantly, brilliantly in prose, in the way that on TV, they just couldn't quite do it.
It was just that tiny thing of just a little bit beyond them in terms of, you know, pacing that and getting that thing. I think the design of the cheetah people probably really doesn't help.
Bless them. Well, what about you, Dan? Have you got any other tidbits before we move on to the recommends?
I think I've got most of it. I mean, I sat going through making all these notes, and I think one way or another, because you know we've done this in no logical order, because I was like, I'm going to try. You know,
that's usually the way,
and that's the best way. That's the most interesting way. Who does Ace ring on the phone? Because I've always wondered that. Yeah. Who does she ring? Who she called? You know, she called home. Is she? And there's a bit where whether or not it's a deliberate thing or not, is obviously there's a whole thing like 10 pence. And that's what Ace puts in Angie's tin. And I thought, is that... Well, sometimes I look for patterns that don't exist. But it's like,
Well, that's a nice one, though. That's a 10 pence where she could have called home.
Because I think she says something like, oh, you're not even got 10p. And she puts it in the collection jar. So it's just little things like that. So that, but... Yeah,
I think she called home that. Forgive me, that because you know she's bisexual now. She called out that girl that she nicked out that time just to say, "I'm still thinking of you." All right, okay. All those latent feelings are coming up inside me since I've been on this planet. I'm joking. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and there's a lot about Ace's. There's things that they set Ace up as this rough character, and there's bits that they don't talk about. I like that. I like the bit where she talks about her experience in the brownies.
Oh, is that the Molotov cocktail?
Yeah, where she's too violent for the brownies.
She blew up the brown owl or something like that, didn't she?
And I just love stuff like that. It's just like, yeah, she's a total delinquent.
My biggest takeaway from Survival, sort of summarize it, is this. Rare glimpse at Ace conceptualized as a total delinquent, slightly unsympathetic, but given a chance at a better life because of the Doctor, and deciding in this book, after going back to the place that sort of created this wild creature, no, I'm done with that and I'm ready to move on from it. And it's a great, I'm not the biggest lover of Ace. It's a great Ace book. And for that alone, I just adored this. It's been one of my biggest surprises in the book club so far.
I think it's an Ace story. I was writing, little things for each character. I was like, this is an Ace story. This is... I've always kind of said, if you how important a character is to a story is, if can you write a synopsis without a character being mentioned? Because, you talk about, like, classic early in the classic series, you could write a synopsis of certain stories and you don't have to mention the companion at all, because they do absolutely nothing to drive the story.
Couldn't do that here.
This is Ace's story, and she drives it and drives that plot. And I can see why, when they started doing the new adventures, when they ran out of target books, they wanted to continue, keep that going, because the way both the book ends, the TV series ends open-ended, I can see why people were clamoring for more adventures with these two, particularly from in prose form as well, because this was one of the last ones. Going, I'd love to see where these two characters at the end of this book go next.
Well, you know why, don't you, David? There are worlds out there where the sky is burning, where the sea is asleep but the rivers dream. No, I won't do the whole thing.
Before the series came, that was such an important speech.
It's gorgeous. He delivers it impeccably.
And the teas are getting cold becomes such a that kind of, the whole thing at tea becomes a big thing in the new adventures as well, and the Doctor, and so that is such an important speech, which isn't in the book because it wasn't meant to be.
I don't know, but I do think what you and I should do then is we should choose an early new adventure that has Ace in it, and let's see where they take her. And see if they do similarly good work.
Oh, but should it be one of the good ones?
Well, I think I'm going to let you choose that one. You go away and have a think.
Oh, I'll have a think. I'll have a think, because there are some good ones in that early run. There are. I've only read the last of the Cat's Cradle books. I needed it because it was one of the first.
Please don't pick one of those, please.
I think when I started collecting them, Witchmark was one I found in a charity shop, and that was when I started collecting them. And I remember reading that, going, the next one better be better than this, because this is awful. So maybe we'll do it. We could well do that one.
Maybe I'll end our survival conversation by just saying, "Come on, David, we got work to do." Well, look, okay, let's move on to do you have a recommend?
I kind of half forgot, but I'm gonna pluck one out of the air,
Oh, wonderful.
and it's what I've mentioned, because if you want an example of how not to do this,
Okay.
go and pick up the Revelation of the Daleks book, because it is. I think there's an idea that doing these novelizations is easy, or that they're just straightforward retellings or whatever. But actually, what when you get a much better respect for the skill of people like Terence Dicks, Rona Munro, and the others who write these really strong adaptations, is when you read some of the really bad ones. And bearing in mind that Revelation is a relatively new-ish adaptation, you would have thought, especially that it would have gone through God knows how many people at Cardiff as well. I'm actually surprised at times that that was allowed to go into print. It is a very good example of how not to do it and how to overflower your language. It is almost the antithesis of survival, and that's why I would recommend it, because it's like it makes you appreciate how strong some of these other books are by reading some
It's
of
for
the ones, but
it's
it
for your
doesn't
own
work.
good that you read this, so you can see how good stuff is, all right?
Yeah, so there you go. A left field one. Go and read a book that's terrible.
Well, actually, do you know, weirdly enough, because I've not read the Revelation of the Daleks one, but I will get around to it eventually. But my least favorite target novelization is the one directly before it, Glenn McCoy's Time Lash, which I think is sort of quite fun on the TV. I mean, it's terrible, but it's quite fun. That book, man, it takes all the fun out and it's just all the tedium of the story. There's a line in it in the first page. I thought, oh, I'm in trouble here, where it said, Perry waited for a pregnant pause. I went, a pregnant pause? What the hell does that mean?
That's on a level with Davros's head spinning 360 degrees.
And yeah, do you know, David, weirdly, I think one of the best Target novelizations ever is the one directly before that, The Two Doctors. Robert Holmes's retelling of that as this very sick, very funny novel is terrific.
Slightly removed from the brilliant direction of Peter Moffat, which I developed a new appreciation of, having wandered around Seville a few weeks ago, and you think, this is a beautiful city. Doctor Who is here. They showed bugger all of it.
Yeah, you would have shot that in a more dynamic way than Peter Moffat, you know, on your camcorder, I'm sure.
Walking around recreating scenes from Doctor Who, but we would not with we would not have been the first fans to do that.
Well, see, now I haven't prepared to recommend either, so I'm going to have to pluck one straight out of the air too. And I think I am going to go for. Oh my God, I can't figure out. Okay. No, wait. I am gonna go for. Wolfsbane by Jacqueline Rayner.
Oh.
Which is a really interesting book, which tells a fourth Doctor story, and then somewhere along the line, Harry Sullivan gets blasted back in time and becomes an eighth Doctor book. And clearly, Jacqueline Rayner is deeply in love with both the fourth Doctor, Sarah and Harry, and the eighth Doctor. And so she writes these fabulous, romanticized versions of all of them, in a way that just makes me love all those characters even more. But then, in a shocking twist, because it's a werewolf story, turns Harry Sullivan into a werewolf at the end of the book and doesn't resolve it.
Was that during the period when the BBC Books was killing off or
Yes.
doing very unpleasant things to previous companions?
And then you get that wonderful scene in Sometime Never where you realise that the Council of Eight have been excising all of the Doctor's companions from his timeline because he's infected, because they were never supposed to meet him. They were supposed to just have normal lives, and he's come along in time and infected all of their timelines. So they're sort of quarterizing time by taking them out of it, which is such a brilliant idea. And the Harry werewolf thing is described as they were going to just kill him, and it went wrong, that their involvement in his involvement went wrong. And so he went off down a different timeline completely where he's a werewolf. It's sort of storytelling on a grand level. But Wolfsbane itself is it's a brilliantly cozy Doctor Who horror book, written in a way that only Jack Rayner can, which is with some very descriptive prose, wonderful character moments, twists and turns, witty lines. It's a really, really gorgeous book in a period where the past Doctor adventures were very hit and miss. This really stood out as something quite impressive.
I think by that time I tuned out the part, I was mostly focusing on EDAs, even though he's in it. In that one, and it's set for the Eighth Doctor during his trapped on Earth isn't it?
Yeah.
So why I never went back and picked that one up, because I thought that cycle of books was absolutely fantastic. I might have to, considering I was recommending the writer before. It's one of the books I never managed to pick up, but I might have to seek that one out. I mean,
it opens up, you know, with Sarah Jane in this beautiful forest covered in blossom. And it just takes you back to Mask of Mandragora, you know, which is in that lovely forest. She just captures the nostalgia of the characters just beautifully.
I think I might have to take that recommend.
Do you have that one?
No, but I might see. The thing is, some of the books are really easy to get hold of. And then every now and again, you go, I wonder how much Lung Barrow's going for these days.
500, according to Dylan Reese, last time he looked.
Yeah, that's insane.
They need to reissue it just to annoy those people.
They need to reissue it or just put them out there in ebook, because they did the ebooks on BBC website for a while. Mm-hmm. And they did Dying Days, they did Lung Barrow, they did those two. It's like, yeah, but I like having a physical copy. I know some people are quite happy with digital, but I like having the book. Because with Revelation, I got it with my Audible credit. But I was like, I did actually go and buy the book. But I was like, well, I listened to it. I didn't like it. But it's like, I quite like the idea of having it on my shelf. So
if you do find a copy of Wolfsbane somewhere, and those past Doctor ones are usually quite easy to find for a reasonable price, maybe we'll cover that one day as well. Need to do more of those.
I've managed to find Quantum Archangel quite easily. That was quite a common one.
I wished you hadn't. Yeah.
I did suggest it.
You did as well. Yeah. Well, we'll get there. David, thank you as ever for your input. I mean, a great book and a great discussion as well, of all the themes and all the fabulous characters. Can I ask you to direct people to, you're becoming a bit of a hamster mainstay now. We've done quite a bit together and we've got loads to come. But where can people find you elsewhere?
You can find me on X, formerly Twitter, at Pi1883. That's generally where I am most of the time. Usually either stuff about Doctor Who or running one of the two. And also sharing stuff for my YouTube channel, which I just occasionally will randomly throw some stuff out. And the last one that I did was on the Mythmakers, on the back of our commentary on that particular story, which is still one of my favourite ones that we've done.
Yeah,
I think that came together really nicely. So I thought I'd like to do a video on something Mythmakers. So if you're interested in Katarina's lost dialogue from episode 4, it is nowhere near as interesting, I think, as people expected it to be.
Always. In fact, my only disappointment with that video, which was fabulous, was when I clicked on the link and it was only 4.5 minutes long, and I was like, no, come on now. But it's as ever, they're not long videos, but they're packed with content. Absolutely packed.
I like, as somebody once said to me, it's like, what I like about your videos is they're short. And it's like, good. Occasionally they might get a little bit longer if there's the content, but I like to keep them short.
But informative. And actually, you know, we got a thumbs up from Tim from the Missing Episodes podcast. And I consider that the greatest endorsement ever for our Mythmakers commentary. Do you know? If those people are giving us the thumbs up, we've done all right.
I think that if they're happy, if they're not telling us off for getting things wrong, I'm quite happy. In fact, Fed, we didn't do too badly getting told
he
off.
He said that your research was superb, I saw in that tweet. Yeah.
I think... I liked the worst thing you can do with Doctor Who fans is go in and not have your facts right, because you'll spend the next week fending off, I'll think you'll find. Well, I haven't got time for that.
I've got to say to you as well, David, that if you're ever, you know, doubting whether you're any good at this sort of podcasting malarkey, that a very well-known podcaster, I shan't name and shame, did actually come at me the other day and went, that David Gillespie Pratt, he's a bit good, isn't he? I said, I know. It's one of mine now. Fuck off, you. But I can reliably inform you, you have recently been on this podcast. We are all sharing you. But no, it's a delight. It's been a delight to find you, to get to know you, and just to talk about these wonderful things.
And it's great fun to do. I look forward to doing them. I mean, I know you... jokingly would like say, are you doing your own podcast? And I'm quite happy just turning up on other people's.
Oh yeah, you ain't good enough to fucking editing, do you? You just come along and have all the fun.
I've got my own editing to do. I've got my own stuff.
Now come on, we're being far too indulgent now. How do we end this thing?
I haven't got a bloody clue. Should we say something about tea getting cold? Is that appropriate?
Should I do the whole speech? Shall I see if I can do it?
Do it.
Okay. There are worlds out there where the sky is burning, where the seas are asleep and the rivers dream. Cities made of song and... Oh no, what is it?
People made of smoke and cities made of song.
People made of smoke and cities made of song. Somewhere there's danger. Somewhere there's injustice. Somewhere else the tea's getting cold. Come on, David. We got work to do.
Brilliant.
Get in there.